Hey everyone, this is Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, and I want to start the show in Congress, because it seems like everyone is leaving. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but in the House of Representatives, at least 24 Democrats are retiring, and more than 20 Republicans. And we should say a number of them, mostly Republicans, are not waiting until the end of their terms to leave. They're getting out right now. Why? And what does this say about our Congress? And what does it say about our country that lawmakers are running away? The latest name on the list, Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher. He is cutting his term short and leaving the House on April 19th. His announcement coincided with the last day for former Colorado Representative Ken Buck. Buck announced his retirement a few months ago and also decided to leave office before November. So Buck's seat is going to be filled in a special election. Former Speaker Kevin McCarthy's empty seat will also be filled this summer. But Gallagher's seat could remain empty, meaning that the slim Republican majority in the House, well, just got slimmer. But I want to play a little bit of what former Colorado Congressman Ken Buck said about this decision to leave.
But a lot of this is personal. That's the problem. Instead of having decorum, instead of operating in a professional manner, this place has just devolved into this bickering and nonsense and not really doing the job for the American people.
All right. A lot to talk about here with these exits. And joining us is Sarah Isger, who is always on our show. She's senior editor of The Dispatch and former spokesperson for the Department of Justice. Moa Lathy is off this week, but we are very glad to have Rui Teixeira with us. He's politics editor at The Liberal Patriot and host of the new Liberal Patriot podcast. Sarah, hello as always. And Rui, thank you for coming on Left, Right, and Center with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. This should be a blast.
Yes, we will make it that. Sarah's laughing. Always
this
a blast.
This is why he's here.
This
so
is why
pumped.
You're here. Well, I just want to start what we were hearing from Congressman Buck there. I mean, Congress, unprofessional lawmakers not doing their jobs for the American people. I mean, what if that's true, what does that mean for our country right now? I'll start with you.
Well, I would say nothing good. I mean, we know that a level of partisanship and rancor in Congress today is sort of off the charts. And the closer you get to you know, sort of this 50-50, everything's always on a knife's edge, the more nasty people are going to be, and the more desperate they're going to become. So, yeah, it's not too surprising that in a situation like this, people would not necessarily have the common good in mind. You know, serving the American people in the best way possible. They're as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. So, you know, that just doesn't lend itself to good legislating and a productive Congress.
Sarah, I feel like you're always so good at pulling me back from drawing sweeping conclusions and providing context. Like, is this that big a deal? Have there been other times in our country's journey where lawmakers have sort of resembled what we're seeing right now?
This is really bad. I'm not
okay. Then, if you're saying that, it's really bad.
Yeah, I think this is like canary in the coal mine, Cassandra at the gates level. Really, really bad because we're seeing waves of retirements, not just people not running again, or not running in the first place, which I think absolutely is also happening. You saw Republicans mm-hmm. try to recruit Chris Sununu in New Hampshire to run for the Senate and Doug Ducey in Arizona to run for the Senate down there. And both of them said no, they would have been top recruits for those seats. And their reasons for saying no were basically like, why would I? That sounds effing miserable. Mm. Because the lunchroom has been taken over by the trolls. You know, the things that are getting rewarded, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, proposing a motion to vacate on the speaker again. And she's surrounded by reporters asking her, Sunday show invitations, social media blowing up. That raises her small dollar donations. It raises her power and stature within the party. And the guy who's been spending the last 2 years working on legislative fix to the humanitarian crisis at the border, nobody's talking to him. So you're incentivizing all the bad things. You're disincentivizing all the good things. And so a lot of people, I know that folks listening don't necessarily believe this, but like, just try to take my word for this. A lot of people run for Congress for the right reasons. They're in their community. They see something wrong. They don't see anyone fixing it, and they step up, even though they had some other career path or families, or, you know, whatever else. It is actually a sacrifice to go move to DC in a crappy basement apartment, and do this job. But they, a lot of them are doing it for the right reasons. Those are the ones that are retiring. So all the Mr. Smiths who went to Washington are GTFO. And the people who are coming with bad faith because they wanted to be reality TV stars, but they didn't make the cut for Survivor, are the ones who are being rewarded. And there's lots of blame to go around. There's blame from other members of Congress. There's blame for the media. But I'll be really honest, a lot of the blame should be with voters, people not showing up to primaries. The people who are showing up to primaries who say they actually want these problems fixed are voting for people who have no intention, no interest in fixing the problems. And I've beat this drum a few times. Well-intentioned people like me who supported campaign finance reform have also created this world because it is now run by small dollar donors, the very thing that we thought would be good, would, you know, these large dollar donors, major donors don't represent real Americans' interests. Well, guess what? The small dollar donors definitely don't. It's a huge, huge disruption when only 2% or so of people are giving $5 or $20 and they are turned on by outrage, not by the problem solvers, by the people who are on social media, and they don't even know about the person who was, you know, legislating. So all bad, wow. Real bad, very bad.
Do you agree with Sarah that, I mean, this is sort of a byproduct of campaign finance reform over the years that was supposed to take money out of politics and make it better?
Well, I do think that has something to do with it. And, you know, the whole primary system in general has not worked as I think it was intended to do in terms of increasing the voice of sort of ordinary voters and the people their party puts forward. The people who are motivated and contribute to these primary campaigns, there tend to be a non-representative slice of both parties. Are the most active, the most ideological, the most educated, the more this is a recipe for producing candidates who are actually not that representative and will pursue an agenda when they get into Congress that'll just increase the polarization and rancor within that institution. They're more running to pursue their ideology at that agenda than they are in many cases to make Congress work and get good stuff done. So I think this is an unintended consequence of the so-called democratization of the candidate selection process. And the campaign finance reform has definitely played into that. I mean, it's just a fact, as Sarah says, small donors are really unrepresentative of ordinary voters. I mean, it's extremely obvious. It's well documented, and nobody should kid themselves if that's not the case.
Well, I want to be careful to...
Wait, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Of Roy, because I feel listeners screaming at this moment, at me mostly, how dare I mention campaign finance reform without mentioning gerrymandering?
Yeah.
And I actually do think that campaign finance reform has had a bigger effect on our current problems than gerrymandering, because we've had gerrymandering the whole time. So you do need to have something that explains why the sudden uptick in congressional dysfunction, both in terms of legislative output, polarization, which is well-documented data-wise. But I'm really curious if Rui agrees that gerrymandering can be a problem and still not be the but-for cause of this problem.
Cause this mess, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, gerrymandering is obviously a problem, and both parties try to do it. They try to game out the system of reapportionment and all that. But people frequently exaggerate the extent to which gerrymandering is responsible for polarization. So much of it has to do with where people live, how the political trends have unfolded in the last 20 or 30 years within these various regions and areas and states and between rural, suburban, and urban areas, and where Democrats and Republicans are concentrated and so on. It's just not the case that gerrymandering can produce any result people want. They do try to maximize within constraints, and those constraints are driven by where people actually live and the leanings of those people in terms of where they live. So you can just really exaggerate that. And because you do that, you can miss the influence of other factors like campaign finance reform and just blame it all on gerrymandering, which is a very easy, but I might add lazy way of understanding the problems we have. And also it tends to be very partisan, right? Because it's those darn Republicans gerrymandering or those darn Democrats gerrymandering. If we could just you know, solve that problem, everything would be great. And I don't think everything would be great. I think that's incorrect.
Well, can I ask, I kind of, I want to be a little careful with the narrative here that some of these members are like heroes who fought as hard as they could to stay in this mess and they're getting out now. Because, I mean, you think about Gallagher in Wisconsin, like he's going to work for a big defense contractor that gave tons of money to his campaign. There's a former Republican strategist, Tim Miller, who said, I mean, he's got people in his district who voted for him, paid his salary. Yeah. They're hardworking and in their jobs. Why shouldn't he stay and finish his term for the people who got him in? Then you have Congressman Buck, who's been in this, you know, long feud with Lauren Boebert, Congresswoman from his state of Colorado. And him getting out now might make it harder for her to win in his district because she's now going to probably have to run against an incumbent who's going to win a special election to be there. So there could be other motivations here. And I just want to say that out loud. But I guess the thing I want to leave our listeners with, this has real implications, this dysfunction. Like, and I'm looking at, you know, Speaker Mike Johnson, who seems to be trying almost quietly to get a Ukraine aid bill through. Like he wants to do it quietly to not wake up the chaotic masses who might stop him. I mean, there's something really weird and bad about that. And then you think about the border bill, which was such a product of compromise. I mean, that falls through. Like our immigration system, aiding Ukraine, these are really important issues that are we're not seeing progress to me because of this very dysfunction.
Well, I mean, in terms of the border bill, though, there's lots of other stuff going on there. I mean, there is this sure. guy named Donald Trump who didn't yes. seem particularly interested in this happening. And my understanding is has a lot of influence. So there's lots of things that have to do with the internal dynamics of each party that were implicated in this, not just, you know, how hard it is to be a moderate today in Congress.
I also just want to point out, like, yep, the retirements you're pointing to, any single one of them, I agree. The problem is the overall trend. And let me point out some other trends, right? It was any of the senators who didn't support Donald Trump on the Republican side are gone. Anyone who voted to impeach Donald Trump on the Republican side are gone because of the Democrats working with Republican primary voters, basically. Chuck Schumer spending $60 million to help primary those people. And it's not just that those people are then gone. It changes who runs next, right? Because to leave your job for, like, even if you win, you're in for 2 years and then you're going to get primaried by Chuck Schumer. So, like, normal people who have real jobs aren't going to do this.
No, I'm just going to say, I mean, it's just logical that if you're changing the incentive structure of being a politician in these circumstances, you're increasing the costs and you're reducing the benefits. And it shouldn't, you know, sort of puzzle us that are fewer people are willing to come forward and that people who are willing to come forward sort of have a different, you know, sort of cost benefit structure of their own that enables them to, like, negotiate these obstacles. But the more normie candidates, you know, they look at that cost benefit structure and they say, oh, are you kidding me? You know, this just isn't worth it.
I've got another problem that we can't fix, which will make you happy, David, like an unfixable problem. And that is, as it turns out, transparency is bad. We all thought transparency was good. And I know you, as a longtime reporter, are pro-transparency. But you're mentioning specific bills and things that aren't getting through. That's largely because of transparency. You know, back in the day when we had earmarks, when everything was getting negotiated in smoke-filled rooms, et cetera,
you make progress in secret because you don't want to wake up the crazies.
But you're also like, look, vote for this thing. I know it's not exactly what you want, but then I'm going to name this post office after you. And that sort of horse trading now with too much transparency in Congress, the earmarks are gone, the whole thing's ground to a halt. Now everyone actually has to agree on the compromise for the policy itself. And that was never the case in Congress. That's not how things were happening, is that we all just sang kumbaya and held hands in the lunchroom.
Sarah, I love that you brought this up, and we have to take a break. But before we do, I need to tell you, I literally wrote my college thesis on housing policy and when transparency is good versus bad and when politics can get involved and ruin it. No one has to read it. No one would want to read it, but it was, I love the
put it on your website so we all can read it.
Exactly. No one wants to read that. Rui and Sarah and I will be back in a moment. We're going to keep the conversation going here on Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green. We're joined by Rui Teixeira, politics editor at the Liberal Patriot and host of the Liberal Patriot podcast. He's filling in for Moa Lathy today. And Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at the Dispatch and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is still embroiled in a debate over whether the abortion drug mifepristone should be pulled from the market. Plaintiffs argue that the drug should not have been approved by the FDA. The court seems unlikely to remove the drug, even as a whole legal back and forth is continuing. But the recent arguments are keeping the issue of abortion in the news at a time when Democrats really want just that, a constant reminder to voters that access to abortion is not something to ever be taken for granted. The Biden campaign is hoping this issue helps them keep the White House this fall, and they've made Vice President Kamala Harris their primary messenger. She became the first sitting vice president or president in U.S. history to visit a clinic that provides abortions.
These attacks against an individual's right to make decisions about their own body are outrageous and in many instances just plain old immoral. How dare these elected leaders believe they are in a better position to tell women what they need, to tell women what is in their best interest. We have to be a nation that trusts women.
Let me start with you. I mean, it's easy to fall into this narrative that the abortion issue is a really strong issue for Democrats to drive turnout, to maybe bring some independents in to vote for President Biden. How true is that narrative based on what you're seeing?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the abortion rights issue at the margin isn't helpful for the Democrats, and it will help them in 2024. The issue is how much. As a rule, the lower turnout the election, the more this is going to help the Democrats because, you know, the Democrats, in a sense, are now a low turnout specialist party. They have, you know, sort of dominate the educated, engaged people who turn out in these lower turnout elections. That's an increasingly a part of their base, and they do very well when the sort of the structure of the election isn't likely to turn out the maximum number of people. And those are the people who respond to an issue like abortion rights in the Democratic base. And then 2024, it's going to be different. This is the highest turnout election we have. Tons of peripheral voters who didn't vote in 2022 or didn't vote in 2023 are going to show up at the polls, and they're far less likely to be motivated simply by protecting abortion rights. They're less ideological. They have more moderate views on the issue. They're probably not abortion rights maximalists as a rule. And I think that the assumption that some Democrats have that if they just talk like nonstop about abortion rights from now until November and put a referendum in as many states as possible, that will totally do the trick. It's an unstoppable political strategy. I don't think that's true at all. We know from the data that tons of people, you know, voted who were for abortion rights or were pro-choice voted for Republicans in 2022 and 2023. We know that Republicans ran far ahead of the no vote and referenda in terms of abortion rights, right? I mean, this just, we know this is the case. So the question is, again, at the margin in 2024, how much will that help? Not whether it will help. And my sense is that conceiving of it as a silver bullet for Democrats is probably not correct. There's so many other issues that are going to be important in this election and such a different complexion of the electorate, so many more peripheral voters. And let's not forget that in terms of abortion, most people are moderates. They don't think abortion should be available throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. They're for some sort of limit. Now, of course, that gets played as a ban when Democrats talk about it. But if you actually poll people on what they think about limiting abortion to the first 16 weeks, with exceptions for rape, incest, the life of the mother and after, it's actually pretty popular. So, you know, can Republicans play this in such a way that convinces people they're not all lunatics who want to just ban abortion full stop?
I would like to answer that question. And the answer is no.
I wouldn't say make it a hard no. I just think it's a challenge. That's why they pay the big bucks.
Sarah, yeah, you haven't seen Republicans finding this way to seem like they don't have crazy extreme policies on abortion?
I like that Rui and I are going to just beat up our own sides for this whole podcast.
Great, that's great.
So
let's
he just explained why Democrats are misunderstanding and overplaying their hand. So let's look at this the other way. Abortion is back in the headlines because the Supreme Court is hearing a case on banning an abortion-inducing drug that's been on the market for 20 years that could be, the headlines at least, even under Rui's theory, right, are not helpful to Republicans. They're bad. It's just how bad. Why are they in the headlines? Who came up with this? It wasn't Democrats who brought this case. It was conservatives who wanted this in the headlines right now. What? Like, did Dobbs teach you nothing? You're the dog that caught the car, and now you're like chewing on a bumper and wondering why you're hungry. It's bewildering. Now, I absolutely agree that when you actually look at the results, when abortion is on the ballot, that ballot thing comes out on the pro-choice side. And I'm going to use pro-choice and pro-life in the loosest sense of the term. I think they're meaningless, but I think everyone will know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But then the candidates who are pro-life still win. So the pro-choice ballot measure wins and the pro-life candidates win. That's frankly bad news for all of the political extremists and ideologues across the board because it's not what they want to believe. They want to believe that everyone's on their side on every issue, by the way, if they would just understand, if we could just message better, if we just had, you know, better candidates. When in fact, sometimes the voting population just has a more nuanced and interesting take than you do. And nobody wants to acknowledge that on any issue. And it's so interesting for the extreme partisan. So take the right on abortion. They are conflating what they say their actual goal is, to lower the number of abortions in the country, with banning abortion. Those are not the same thing.
Not at all.
Abortion bans don't necessarily lower the number of abortions in the country. And in fact,
they increase them sometimes.
The number of, they sometimes increase them. So right. The right will have to decide what their actual goal is and how to chart a path to that, because they were so sort of the shibboleth was that overturning Roe would decrease the number of abortions, i.e. banning abortions would decrease abortions. Or if you left this to the state, actually the pro-life position is really popular. They're going to have to accept that it's not quite what they thought. Now, again, I think Rui's right. Most people are somewhere in the middle, which means Democrats aren't right either. But politically, I've heard, Democratic strategists say reproductive rights is the number one issue for voters this fall. Do you actually believe that? Are you saying that because you're on TV right now? Or do you, are you actually that wrong? Because if you think that, you've missed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, also, there's no support for that in the data. I mean, reproductive rights is not the number one issue for voters. Certainly the number one issue for some voters.
Well, it's they can spin it and say number one issue. They can make it up and be like, well, you know, my gut feeling in my constituents is that it's it's the number one issue.
Trust
but
me
what,
on this.
Who is anyone speaking for the middle on it, on this issue? And I mean, so many others. Like,
no, they retired from Congress, David. They left.
Let me ask this a different way. Is the fact that the majority in the middle has a more nuanced view on abortion, doesn't want full access all the time, doesn't want abortion banned, is that at some point—
They also,
point,
by the way, can believe that abortion is morally wrong without wanting it to be illegal, right?
Totally.
Like adultery.
Who is speaking
for— And so
for,
like, there's different versions of that too. There's different policy nuances, but there's also different moral nuances, and nobody's willing to talk about any of those.
But are the parties— Are they feeling the pressure to talk about these things and represent these views in the middle? And if
no,
not,
I don't think so. Well, let's look at it from the Democrats' perspective, okay? They benefited in 2022 and 2023 running against the Republicans on the abortion issue. And they inevitably, and in every case, I'm not talking about something like the Kansas referendum, I'm talking about candidates. They sought to portray the Republicans as they will ban abortion full stop. Even if they said something different, like in Virginia, they say, okay, that's just an excuse. When they get into power, they really are going to ban abortion completely. So there's no interest on the Democratic side in sort of entertaining arguments about what limits maybe there should be. You know, what do American people really want? They're basically, they feel they benefit for politically from being able to typecast all Republican attitudes is essentially being a ban abortion completely. And it also therefore avoids the internecine party fights that will be attended upon arguing for any kind of limit, right? I mean, they're abortion rights activists in the party, the groups, they're not interested in, you know, like a 16-week limit or an 18-week limit. They're interested in no restrictions on abortion per se, you know, simplistically, right? It's kind of like abortion is healthcare. So that's the incentives for them aren't there to moderate their position, I think, at this point.
And let's bring a theme through this. The reason that the incentives aren't there are largely the ones we just talked about in the last segment, David.
Voters.
Which is money, voters, that, you know, one of the most powerful groups in the late 90s and early aughts on the Republican side was Republicans for Choice. That group literally and metaphorically doesn't exist anymore as of 2018. They shuttered their doors. And yeah. On the Democratic side, there is now only one pro-life member of any elected Democrat in Congress. He's a Texas Democrat down the border in Texas. That's it. One pro-life Democrat. And so why is that? Well, because if you take a nuanced position, you get primaried.
Right.
And that same small dollar donor thing, the same ideological primary voter problem is, you know, going to push Congress to be more dysfunctional. And now we're just at the micro level of what that actually looks like on a specific issue.
On an issue like
so
this,
no,
yeah.
There is no one who represents the middle because there's no primary voters for that. There's no small dollar donors for that. And so therefore, that person can't get elected.
Yeah, there's no incentive structure.
Well, back to the Kamala clip. I mean, look at how she was playing the issue. I didn't detect much moderation there. It was kind of like the Republicans, those fascists, they're out to take your freedoms away from you, prevent, you know, a woman from doing what she wants with her own body. You know, this will not stand.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. I want to ask you, we brought up who Democrats might, you know, turn out. And, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, more educated voters who turn out in low turnout campaigns for Democrats. It looks like the party is maybe even doing slightly better with American voters who have more education, college education, postgraduate education. But this Gallup poll recently...
Not a little better, a lot better.
A lot better. But this Gallup poll shows Democrats still losing support among Black voters, among Hispanic voters. This voter demographics is kind of your line of work. I mean, how worried should Democrats be, and what are they getting wrong here?
Well, I think they should be super worried. I mean, the theory of the case for Democrats since the teens has been, you know, we are mobilizing the coalition of the ascendant. We're getting creamed among white working class voters. And of course, that really happened big time in 2016, but it had been happening before. But we just got to get our own people out to the polls. We got to get the minorities, Hispanics, Asians, Blacks especially. We've got to get the young people. We got to get, you know, our people to the polls, the professionals, the more educated parts of the population, which are moving in our direction. But how appealing is all that, or has that been, the kind of approach the Democrats have taken to cultural and to some extent economic issues last 15 years? How attractive is that to, you know, basically non-white working class voters? It's just not that attractive. It hasn't been a big hit. The kinds of things that animate the educated base and liberal-leaning base of the Democratic Party today, especially the cultural issues, are far more attractive to these voters than they are to Black and Hispanic working class voters, for example, whose interests in what parties can do for them are much more mundane, much more day-to-day, much more have to do with everyday life. They're not interested in a lot of the boutique cultural issues Democrats have become identified with. And they're going to judge the party on the basis of whether it really seems to be helping them or not. And just to give you an example, Obama in 2012, just an empirical example, he carried non-white working class voters, so Black, Asian, Hispanic working class voters, by 67 points. And 2020, despite running against Donald Trump again, the great, presumably bete noir of minority voters, Biden's advantage dropped to 48 points among those voters. So a 19-point decline. The latest New York Times Siena poll, and other polls are somewhat consistent with this, had Biden's advantage over Trump at 6 points. So maybe that's a little bit too little, right? I mean, but clearly there's a shift going on. We do see minority voters moving toward the Republicans. We do see party ID declining among these minorities for the Democrats. We do see changes in voting behavior. And again, this is really driven by the working class segment of the Black and Hispanic communities, which is immense. Of course, the change has been biggest among Hispanics. We are starting to see it now among Blacks. And so I would be really worried, because does the coalition of the ascendant work if you get more voters over time in a given bucket, but they move against you very substantially, it doesn't work because that cancels out the effect of more voters being in that bucket, right?
Sarah, I think what Ruiz describing also is an image problem for the Democratic Party. I mean, if they don't want to be seen as just the party of the liberal elite, and yet they're relying so heavily on just more educated voters and not the working class, and losing a lot of voters who, you know, have hardworking jobs and are trying to get by. It's like whatever they're doing to draw in more educated voters, I think, validates the image that this is the party of the elite. And that feels problematic for me.
And it was problematic for the Republicans when it was true for them. Just think of all the messaging about the Republicans being the rich, elite, you know, old people crowd.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly how the two parties are realigning. And I think what will make it worse potentially for the Democrats is all the institutional capture that will come with for them. Basically, Hollywood, universities, the things that they already had, but then they were the blue collar party. And so they kind of balanced each other out, right? Those things will now add to the badness of the image. Like, you're the party of the wealthy and you're the party of the elite. And so, yeah, it's not going to be particularly helpful when then a bunch of Hollywood stars also come out who are rich and elite, or the universities are total, you know, indoctrination bubbles on DEI stuff or whatever, because that will also feed into the elite perception. Whereas before it was a little countercultural, they have a real problem if it's not countercultural now.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And speaking of universities, Sarah and Rui and I will come back to talk about an interesting law in Indiana dealing with faculty at public universities in that state. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. I'm here with Sarah Isger and Rui Teixeira. He's politics editor at The Liberal Patriot, host of The Liberal Patriot podcast, and filling in for Moa Lathy today. So when we talk about diversity, I think our instincts can lead us to think of things like race or gender, even class, these markers of the ways in which we're different and how they influence our perspectives and certainly examples of diversity. Some critics say that we should also focus, you know, not just on these markers, but also on diversity of thought. And one state is doing something about this. The state of Indiana is the focus of our 50 States series this week. This is the series where we are trying to examine local stories in every state ahead of the election to see what we can learn about our national political conversation. Indiana has passed a law that will require professors at public universities to ensure that different perspectives are welcome in their classrooms. And if they fail to do this, they could lose their jobs. And that applies even to tenured professors. Supporters of this law have made clear that the goal is to make sure that conservative views are invited on college campuses, making students with more conservative points of view feel more comfortable and not isolated.
Few people can tell me with a straight face that across every department of every university in our state, that students are being exposed to rigorous scholarly debate that crosses ideological lines. And I believe that contributes to a low-going university attending in rate in our state, which trails the national average and is on the decline. And it's also a disservice to students of all political stripes when they're not challenged and exposed to debate. And so it's in a measured attempt to try to reinforce academic freedom and tenure rights, but also to ask a little bit more to change that culture.
That is the voice of Spencer Deary there. He's the Republican state lawmaker who authored this bill. Sarah, I know this is an issue that has been really important to you. You have talked about conservative students really being at a disadvantage on many campuses because their views can be dismissed, mocked. There's just no feeling that there are a place for those views to be expressed. If that is indeed a problem on a lot of campuses, is this the solution in your mind?
Probably not, unfortunately. I wish it were. I wish it were so easy that if we just had a piece of legislation, like, boom, we fixed everything in higher ed. And let me correct one thing you said. conservative students are at a disadvantage in terms of getting good grades or teacher recommendations or mentorship, but they're at a huge advantage in terms of becoming bilingual because they'll leave college speaking fluent conservative and fluent liberal because that's the language that they had to speak in class and in their papers and assignments.
Well, that's interesting.
Liberals, on the other hand, have no idea what conservatives actually believe, and it's always been very fun and stunning to go on some of these campuses and get asked questions like, why don't Republicans want gun control? It's like a really good question. It's not a stupid question at all. They have no idea. They've never been exposed to that. Whereas I promise you, every conservative student on campus can tell you exactly what Democrats believe on gun issues. So it's a disservice to liberal students as well. Now, why this won't fix it? Because I was not able to get into the weeds of the text of the bill. I don't know if it'll pass constitutional muster. There's all sorts of protections for the First Amendment rights of the students on campus, but there's also protections for the employees, the professors.
Yeah, and their not First to mention Amendment academic
rights.
Freedom,
and the
principle.
First
yeah.
Amendment rights, and tenure and academic freedom that are guaranteed in their contracts. So let's set aside the legal problems. That's not really how you change the culture. And it's a cultural problem. My argument would be that the schools themselves have to want their students to be part of a rigorous civic conversation in the country. And it is better for the university. But I also think some of this is the admissions process. I mean, I can point to all sorts of individual things. It's the hiring process for professors. And that they're not really allowed to have someone come to the university who doesn't already agree with everyone else who's already there. That's not healthy. But in the admissions process, I find this really interesting. You know, at these elite schools, and I'm including, you know, Purdue University as an elite school, any of these elite schools, they're looking for students who stand out. And how do these students stand out? By showing that they're activists. And I don't mean activists even necessarily on a political issue, but basically that by 17 years old, they are totally sure of their worldview and they are going to be active in promoting that worldview. And so you end up with a whole lot of activists on campus and you don't have people who are being promoted for their intellectual curiosity, their humility, their desire to learn about the world, because by definition, they're accepting people who already think they know everything about the world. So legislation doesn't fix that problem. An admissions process that changes the incentives does, because I promise you a whole lot of these students will get a whole lot more curious if that's how you get into Princeton.
Well, and if you make it part of the education from the beginning, I'm not dismissing at all what you have long, you know, really talked about. I mean, that there is a bias on campuses that you know, makes it a different experience for students who arrive with conservative views. But I also think that some of the problems we're talking about are much broader and across the spectrum. It's a lot of people today, students arrive without any experience at all, having meaningful conversations with other people, being curious, being intellectually humble and wondering about different perspectives. I mean, those kinds of things, those are some of my favorite conversations in college in the late 90s. And I feel like students who are arriving today, having spent a lot of time, as we've said, on social media, and our culture just doesn't encourage those kinds of conversations anymore. So you immediately go into your echo chambers. And frankly, like there's a lot of punishment sometimes in this current climate for bringing up hard things and expressing a view, because you might be told, like, you've offended me, you're wrong. And so that doesn't incentivize you to ask people questions about their lives, their beliefs. And so it really, it's a deeper problem here. And I agree with you. I think this law does not solve this problem that we're talking about at all. And I think it'll backfire. You'll have a lot of professors who are just constantly looking over their shoulders and wondering if they're going to do something wrong. And that's not good for a climate on a campus either.
Well, let me rise in defense, if I may, of some
of this law?
Of SB 202, because you're really only concentrating on part of the law, which is highly problematic, which I'll get to. But it also does the following. It prohibits use of political litmus tests in hiring, promotion, tenure, post-tenure review at admission using language from FIRE, you know, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Freedom Protection Act. It requires student orientation program on the importance of free inquiry and free expression. It requires institutional departmental neutrality on political, moral, ideological issues similar to the University of Chicago's Calvin Report. It allows the State Commission for Higher Education to conduct a survey of students about their perceptions of free speech and academic freedom on campus, and expressly protects faculty members from retaliatory action based on their research or commentary, including criticism of an institution. All that's great. If they just strip the rest of the stuff out of the bill, I think it's highly worthy of supporting. Unfortunately, it's getting all the ink, and what we've implicitly or explicitly been talking about is this ridiculous provision that you could revoke the tenure of somebody who doesn't promote intellectual diversity in the classroom. What the hell does that mean? Totally unenforceable,
right.
Probably unconscious. I mean, this is like directly against academic freedom. It doesn't protect it. So that part of the bill, and again, that's what people are talking about, is highly problematic. And I would, be very opposed to it. But I think this other stuff is cool. I mean, it'd be good. And I think it's a real problem on campuses with illiberalism and, the sort of groupthink on campus, the sanctions that are people who differ from the politically correct orientation. I mean, all these things are real problems. You do need more intellectual diversity. The question is, how do you get it? I mean, I think the things I just read out would be somewhat helpful at the margin. I mean, it's absurd for scholars to have to take DEI pledges to get hired and all that jazz. I mean, that's just insane. So I think, beginnings of pushback against that is good. But I agree with Sarah that in the end, it's a lot of cultural problem. And you just need a different orientation to who you hire and the kind of debate and dialogue on campus, a different regime almost, right? But the DEI stuff is, is crazy. And the more that there's pushback against that, the better. But you're not going to be able to change the atmosphere on campuses by threatening to sanction people who don't do vaguely defined things like promote intellectual diversity. That is asking for trouble. I think it's worth thinking about the positive things in this bill while recognizing there's some crazy parts too. And it just shows the incredible difficulty of trying, and this is really what Sarah's getting at, legislate a change in campus atmosphere.
And David, can I just plug this piece that was in The Atlantic? Because I think I was talking about sort of conservative as conservatives, right of center. But I also want to emphasize how right you are. It's really anyone who is to the right of anyone else. So the liberals, the center left liberals on campus are also victims of this problem on campus, because it's this constant move. Whoever can outflank each other to the far left is the privileged voice. It's sort of the out victimhood, out privilegedhood, out I'm offended by your speechhood. So this piece in The Atlantic, The War at Stanford, I didn't know that college would be a factory for unreason, written by Theo Baker. First of all, you're going to be stunned by the writing and reporting abilities of this Stanford college student. But it opens with a section leader in his computer science class that says, I'm not calling for a civilian to do it, but I think the military should. What's he referring to? Killing Joe Biden.
Yeah,
I'd be happy
that.
If President Biden were dead. I'm not calling for a vigilante to do it, but I'm saying he is guilty of mass murder and should be treated in the same way that a terrorist with darker skin would be. And we all know terrorists with dark skin are typically bombed and drone-striked by American planes. He also said that he believed Hamas's October 7th attack was a justifiable act of resistance, that he would actually prefer Hamas rule America in place of its current government. That was the section leader at Stanford who's telling this to his students in a computer science class. So do you think that that feels very open to dialogue and question asking?
I mean, what do you even do if you're in that class? Like, what do you...
you switch out of the class. He dropped the class.
He's
like, I switched to a different class.
Do you think this law in Indiana would prevent that from happening in a classroom?
No, that's the problem. the stuff that's good here is much more sort of, the Calvin Report, no political litmus tests, programming the importance of free inquiry, doing surveys. So these are all good, but it doesn't address the problem of these lunatics who have control over the classes and minds of students and the whole atmosphere where people who have heterodox views are punished, socially or in other ways. Look, I don't have any doubt in my mind that if I was a professor on a campus today, and most of the places I might likely to be in a decent university, I would get in trouble. I just would. Because I think so much of the DEI stuff in universities today, it's just baloney. And I just have very heterodox views and a lot of issues that people on the left feel strongly about. And I would express them in the course of my life. And I wouldn't toe the party line. I think I'd be in trouble. I know lots of people who have gotten in trouble. This is completely unacceptable, right? Universities are for free expression and debate. That's what they're for. We should expose people to uncomfortable ideas. And until and unless the atmosphere of campuses and the regime changes in that way, it'll continue to be a somewhat unpleasant and less productive place for a lot of students to be. And I completely disapprove of it.
But who gets to decide what's an uncomfortable idea and what is?
Yeah, but that's not literally a computer science idea.
Right. Right? Yes. Yes.
That's a political, Jeremiah.
Very right? good point.
It's ridiculous for, you know, people in a computer science section to be subjected to that. I think that should be debated. That's fine in a, sort of a Middle East course or whatever. Hamas, they got the reasons. They're the only way Palestinians could defend themselves. I don't agree with that, but I think it should be discussed. Yeah. Just like things about race and racism should be discussed. I mean, people are entirely entitled to argue the United States today is a white supremacist society, but people should be entitled to disagree and say, no, I don't think that's right. I think that's baloney, as a matter of fact. So we just need the kind of open discussion about sensitive issues, in sort of appropriate places, right? Where that's part of the subject matter of courses and debates and, events. Yeah. And let her rip. That's my motto. Let her rip.
All right. Well, let's end on let her rip. We're going to have to leave it there. And it is time now for our left, right, and center rants and raves. Ruit Shera, I will turn the floor over to you since you are our guest today.
Well, since I haven't thought a lot about it, I'll just put in my plug for Anthony Pohl's Dance to the Music of Time, which is a 12-volume novel about the course of English life, focusing more or less on the upper class from like the end of World War I through the 1960s. And it's one of the crowning achievements of English literature and will tell you more about English society than you've ever known before. And it's just very funny, very beautifully observed and written. And, most people in America don't read it. It's very popular in the UK. People know all about it. But here in the United States, people don't read enough Anthony Pohl. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. Sarah?
I want to talk about the kerfuffle with Ronna Romney McDaniel, who signed a contract to be an NBC News contributor, and then NBC changed their mind after backlash from their employees. Understandable backlash, given that Ronna Romney McDaniel said a lot of things, did a lot of things, and supported a lot of things around January 6th. But I want to pull people out and above some of that and note that this isn't the first time we've seen this happen. The New York Times getting rid of James Bennett for publishing an op-ed that they, the left employees didn't agree with. Kevin Williamson being pushed out of The Atlantic for writing about abortion in a way that the left-wing employees didn't agree with. I, once upon a time, had a contract with CNN and was shelved because the left-wing employees didn't like that I'd worked for the Trump administration. So here's what I'll say. I don't have a problem if you don't want to platform Ronna Romney McDaniel. I understand the reasons why, but it is a problem when there's always some reason why you don't need to hear from the people you don't like. And I might even make the case that having Ronna Romney McDaniel on MSNBC and NBC and hearing how she defends what she thinks and what she did and Trump and all of those things might actually be helpful, not to persuade you, not to change your mind, but just to understand, because there's a lot of people out there who think the way that she does. And maybe it's a good thing to platform the people who you really, really dislike the most.
I'm all for hearing points of view.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Let her rip. That fits with my theory.
Let her rip. It fits with yours. I am with you. There is always a benefit in hearing from people who have been at the center of power, at the center of things, even if you don't like what they have to say. All right, I'm gonna rave about many of the parents in Nashville, Tennessee, who are parents of kids at the Covenant School. It was the 1-year anniversary of the massacre at the Covenant School in Nashville that took the lives of 3 kids and 3 adults. I got to spend time in Nashville around the 1-year anniversary. I'm working on a film, and some of the parents welcomed me into their worlds, and I heard about some of what their kids went through. I heard about the beautiful lives that were taken. And one of the things that just really stood out is there are a lot of people in Nashville who are just committed and passionate about finding solutions when it comes to this epidemic of gun violence in our country that is open to all perspectives and really brings everyone to the table to figure out how we can all solve this together as a country. And that is incredibly inspirational. And I just want to say that we're all grieving with you, Nashville. That Covenant Massacre was unthinkable and unimaginable. And you are an inspiration on that anniversary to me and many other people. Okay, that is our show for today. Sarah Isger, Rui Teixeira, thank you for being here. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Want to give special thanks to Digital Island Studios here in New York City. You always make me feel like I have a home away from home when I'm in Manhattan to do the show. Really appreciate it. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green, and hope you come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.